This week, I asked WBGO's Alex Arif to interview his friend, bassist Michael League. He's the leader of the Grammy Award-winning instrumental group Snarky Puppy. They spoke in my Manhattan apartment about Snarky Puppy's unexpected rise to popularity and the band's ambitious collaboration with the Metropole Orkest from the Netherlands. We bring you that conversation now.
I'm sitting here with band impresario, multi-instrumentalist, band leader, composer, businessman, and frontman for the worst band name in jazz, yes. Snarky Puppy.
I can't even spell impresario.
Tell me, Mike.
Yes.
Why Snarky Puppy?
Oh, God. Isn't there like a sheet that you're supposed to get at the beginning of these interviews that says, say, do not ask this question? You know, the real story, the real extensive story, and I will never, ever tell the story again because I absolutely despise questions like this, Alex. My brother was in an Irish band 15 years ago with a fiddler named Sarah Nissenson, who was engaged to a tenor saxophone player named Bobby Reed, who is the longtime saxophonist for Bruce Hornsby. Bobby named some like kind of like fake record label or something that he was putting out independent recordings. I don't even know if it was a record label or what he said. It was something Snarky Puppy. And my brother and Sarah were deciding whether to name their Irish band Snarky Puppy or Roaring Mary, but Roaring Mary sounded more stereotypically Irish. So they went with that, and Snarky Puppy just went into the trash can and I pulled it out for no reason. If I knew that we'd still be a band 10 years later, there's no way that I would have named the band Snarky Puppy. VH1 Behind the Music taught me that when Motley Crue was trying to come up with their band name, they were basically like, what can we name our band that everybody already knows and already likes? So they would name themselves Christmas at first because they were like, everybody likes Christmas and they know it. And then they changed their name. So in an indirect way, Snarky Puppy's been convenient just because most people like dogs, especially small ones. So even if they hate our super awesome smooth jazz music, they like dogs, so it can work. I grew up with dogs, Beagle Basset puns.
You went to Denton after auditioning at a few other music schools.
I did.
And your main instrument was guitar.
Yes, that's right.
And you came to Denton as a guitarist or
no,
as a bassist?
As a bass player.
As a bassist. And you get to Denton and, you know, you're in jazz school, but you escape to Dallas to play at church.
I had like 3 or 4 church gigs that I was playing every Sunday, but in white churches.
Okay.
At the end of one of them, I was exhausted and I was driving home and a buddy of mine called me and said, hey man, can you play in the house band at this jam session in Fort Worth tonight at the Black Dog, I think was what it was called. The bass player canceled and I was like, man, I'm really tired. I don't think I can do it. And he said, just do me a favor, man. Like, can you help me out? And I was like, sure. This is the drummer. It's true. So I go to this session. Nobody really shows up for the session. It's like a 3-hour session that pays $50. But this one guy came, this trumpet player named Philip Lassiter. Phil, you know, is a white kid who grew up in Oklahoma, you know, the son of a preacher, and but he kind of got his name out there doing horn arrangements for all the biggest gospel artists in the world, like Kirk Franklin and John P. Key, and then other artists like Ledisi and people like that. Mm-hmm. And now Phil is actually the chief arranger for Prince's 14-piece NPG horn section. Phil came to the session And he asked if I played electric bass, and I said, yeah, and I had my electric in the car, so I played, we played at some tune, Red Clay, I think. And he said, cool, you play at churches? And I said, yeah. And he said, you should play at my church sometime. And I said, great, cool. So a week or two goes by, and he calls me. He says, hey, it's Phil from the jam session. Can you play at the church? And I said, sure, yeah, I'll play at your church. And I showed up and got on stage, and I realized that I was on stage with the RH Factor, with Roy Hargrove's RH Factor, without Roy. It was Bernard Wright on keyboards, Jason Thomas on drums, Keith Anderson on sax, Todd Parsnell on guitar, and Philip Lassiter playing organ and singing and leading worship. So I was confused and frightened, you know, because this is a band that I'd grown up listening to all through college, not knowing that all of its band members were just living 30 miles south of me. So I was playing with Bernard 3 days a week, and he would take me to these jam sessions that were happening, that were like where the black music scene in Dallas would play, where all the guys from Erykah Badu's band were playing, where Kirk Franklin's band, Fred Hammond's band, Marcus Miller's band, they're all Dallas guys, and they were all just living 30 minutes away from me when I was in college, playing their gigs on their scene, and never the two scenes met. You know what I mean? The white jazz scene in Denton and the black gospel R&B jazz scene in Dallas. It was crazy to me. So I kind of like got dropped into the middle of this scene by coincidence, and I dragged the guys in my band with me. And the Dallas and the Denton scenes began to integrate. All because of a jam session. All because of a $50, 3.5 hour jam session.
That's why you go to jam sessions, kids.
That's right, kids. Jam.
Speaking with Michael League, the band leader and chief composer arranger for Snarky Puppy. So, what was Snarky Puppy's first gig?
Snarky Puppy's first gig was a show that was in the basement of a pizza place in the town square in Denton, Texas, J&J's Pizza. In this, like you'd go into the pizza place, and then there was this little staircase that you'd walk down. It's still there; you can still do it. You walk down, and it's like stone walls. It kind of looks like a medieval torture chamber or a dungeon where you can enjoy your $1 Schlitz malt liquor and really good pizza. And there were 10 of us playing in the band, and it was great. Everybody brought 3 friends, and the place was packed.
Yeah,
30 people. It was great. Yeah, it was fun. Very fun.
And then it went from there. I mean, word of mouth, you guys were able to build through that community a following, a local following at first, right?
Sure. The kids in the jazz school liked it because it wasn't swingy, dingy, dingy right. Jazz, you know? It was way jazzier than it is now. It was more like world music
right.
and kind of ECM-ish jazz, you know? But with some groove stuff. Right. But none of us were accomplished groove players, so we kind of stayed away from the super funky kind of stuff. We were listening to it, of course, in college. I was really, you know, like, my favorite record was Voodoo, like D'Angelo's Voodoo. Whenever it rains, feel this way.
Little something to get me through this day. Give me a little bit. How many pups can you cram in a van?
In a 15-passenger van, we've done 15 often. Yes.
And how many pups can you cram in a hotel room?
The most we've ever done was 9 in one room. That's an interesting story in itself. We had 2 rooms. We got this ridiculous deal in New Orleans at the Hotel Le Cirque, which is a really nice hotel, but it had just opened, and they were doing like $50 rooms as a promo. So we said, great, we'll get 2. We'll splurge. We'll get 2 hotel rooms instead of staying with friends. So we put five guys in each room. But by the end of the night, one of the guys had found company. And we wanted to facilitate, you know, an enjoyable evening for him. So we put nine guys in one room.
I mean, that speaks to the camaraderie that you guys have been able to build. And you can see it on the bandstand. You can see it in the sacrifices that you make. They make for you, trusting sure. in you. And, you know, you once disclosed to me that you maxed out credit cards, you rented vans, and all the while these guys are following you and your vision. You know, where did you learn your business savviness from?
Is maxing out a credit card considered business savviness? There are definitely people who chimed in, but ultimately, you know, I think this is one of those things that you can only learn from going out and doing it and falling on your face and learning from that. You know.
Well, let's hear one of the tunes from that era of the band when you guys were first starting to hit the road. Let's listen to White Cat, the very first track on Tell Your Friends.
Sure thing.
This is Alex Arif for The Checkout from WBGO. I'm sitting here with Michael League from the band Snarky Puppy. And we're just about to get into the making of their fifth record, Ground Up, recorded inside of Matthew Garrison's performance space, Shapeshifter. Matthew Garrison, electric bassist and son of bassist Jimmy Garrison. Shapeshifter Lab hadn't even opened yet before Michael and Snarky Puppy moved in to record Ground Up. Let's talk about that.
It was December of 2000, maybe 11?
2011.
Why would you ask me if you knew the answer to that question?
the space wasn't complete. The heaters weren't on.
You're right. It was freezing. It was December in New York. It was freezing. Sure. We were playing, we were rehearsing in gloves and coats.
Describe to me the feeling when you first walked into Shapeshifter Lab, and how did you hear about the lab?
I heard about it through my friend Simon Yu, who is a great musician in New York as well as a videographer. He shot a lot of that. He was one of the camera ops at that DVD shoot. Simon said, "Hey, yeah, Matt Garrison just opened this space," and I'm a big fan of Matt's, of course, as a bass player. And so he said, "Matt just opened the space. It's big. I know you want to do a thing with an audience, so maybe it'll work." So I said, "Great." I walked in a few months earlier, saw it. Looked great. I was like, great, there's plenty of space. All we need is a space. Because in New York, space is hard to find, you know. So I loved it. And then we walked in to record there, and I was like, oh, okay, cool. Well, it's not quite done, but that's fine. But the guys were like, "You see, really? Like, we're going to record in here? It's just like in a big empty room." Because, you know, they hadn't done anything to it. It was just walls. So we brought the entire studio into the room. You know, we brought every microphone, every cable, every stand, every piece of gear, you know, the computer with studio monitors. We brought everything. We just built a studio in there in like 2 days and then recorded for 3 days and then tore everything down.
Why would you do that to yourself?
No. I ask that question a lot. Why do I do this to myself? I'll tell you why. Because for what we wanted to do, it was the right thing. We couldn't do that in a normal New York studio because New York studios aren't big enough. They have the infrastructure for recording, but you can't fit 40 audience members in an 18-piece band in any of these rooms without paying, you know, 3 G's a day. And we did the, I think I paid Matt Garrison, because remember, it wasn't even in existence then. It wasn't open legally. I think I paid him $2,000 for a week there, you know, because he was like, well, I'm not going to be making money there anyway. I mean, it's not open yet, and it's a cool project. And I said, that's all I have. And he said, that's fine. We set up in a recording studio, but we invite a live audience of anywhere between 30 and 80 people in to sit amongst the band with headphones on so that they're listening to the music as it's being recorded, exactly as we are hearing it. So it's kind of like an audience member experiencing the creation of an album the way the musicians do. You know, it's a unique thing.
Let's listen to one of my favorite moments from Ground Up, the entire session, which is the organ break on Young Stuff, as played by our good friend Corey Henry.
You got it.
That's Young Stuff from the band Snarky Puppy off their 2012 release, Ground Up. When we come back, our conversation continues with Alex Arif and Snarky Puppy founder bassist Michael League. League will talk about his 2014 Grammy win and how he spearheaded the effort to build a forest inside an abandoned power plant in the Netherlands. This is The Checkout. I'm Simon Rentner.
We got to talk about the Grammy. You bring the family dinner project to Roanoke, Virginia, and you bring everybody down from New York.
Sure.
Some people from the South as well, right?
Yeah.
Come up to Roanoke to record collaborations with Snarky Puppy as a house band, as you used to do it at Rockwood Music Hall.
That's true.
Layla Hathaway is one of the guest artists. Let's not downplay the rest of the cast, all amazing artists. Layla Hathaway, during dress rehearsal, does she do what she does on the track?
No. No, not at all. You're talking about splitting her voice into three notes at the same time. No, she did not do that. She didn't even split it into two. No, we just rehearsed the tune, and there was like a there's a solo section, and she kind of, you know, experimented with some things and sounded great. But she saves it. She's such a spontaneous person, and she's all about, like, the moment, you know, and the live performance. So yeah, then we performed that song twice, and the last set. Afterwards, we were all like, what in the hell?
Did she tell you she'd been rehearsing it?
She just said, yeah, I've been practicing that for, like, a little while, like, trying to split my voice. But the thing that's amazing about what she does, you know, she sings a chord at the same, three pitches at the same time, but the thing that makes it so incredible is that she was improvising with our organist, Corey Henry. They were improvising together over no known set of chord changes. They were just, it was like a church kind of moment where they're just flowing. And he played a chord that was like a real curveball for her, for any singer, and she just sang it right back to him, which was, that's what makes the moment so special, is it's not just this kind of athletic, crazy, freak show feat. It's that she was improvising with him musically and basically just sang back exactly the chord that he played, which was bananas.
That was Layla Hathaway with Snarky Puppy, and I'm sitting here with band leader Michael League of Snarky Puppy and bassist. The same year Family Dinner is released, you head to the Netherlands.
Yes.
To record We Like It Here.
Yeah, it was instrumental music, mostly tunes that I had written, a few from other guys in the band, which makes it kind of a normal Snarky Puppy record, if there is such a thing.
I mean, you have strings involved, which would make it a normal Snarky Puppy record.
Yeah, we had a Dutch string quartet, yeah.
And you have a tune on there called Lingus,
yes,
which is named after the Irish airline.
Aer Lingus, yes.
Aer Lingus.
Which means fleet. Yes.
Did you have an experience on Aer Lingus?
I did have an experience on Aer Lingus. I was flying from New York to London via Shannon, Ireland, and I was sitting next to this guy from Manchester, UK. He was like a party boy, you know, he was a few years younger than me and had just come back from like Colombia or something, you know, just like partying his face off. And he was just getting obliterated on this flight, just pounding beers and like crumpling them up and throwing them at my feet and trying to make, you know, horrible conversation with me. So the only thing I could basically do to like get this guy off my back was to put on headphones and start working just to get him to stop.
Yeah. And how do you work on the airplane?
Well, I just, you know, pulled out my laptop and this little tiny 3-octave MIDI controller, you know, and you just plug it in with a USB and you can play. It's like a little piano.
Yeah, yeah.
A MIDI controller is like a, you know, like a tiny piano that needs a computer for sound. So, yeah, put the headphones on. Plug the MIDI controller into the laptop and compose, you know, on GarageBand, I think.
Yeah.
At that time. And it was turned out to be Lingus.
Lingus, We Like It Here from Snarky Puppy. I'm Simon Rettner, the host of The Checkout. This week I asked WBGO's Alex Arif to speak with his friend Michael Leake. He's the bassist and bandleader of Snarky Puppy. In their conversation, Michael Leake talks about his most ambitious project to date with the Metropole Orchestra.
Tell me how you built a forest to record a symphony.
Oh, man. Well put. During the sessions that We Like It Here, some very special people showed up, which are the managers of the Metropole Orchestra, which is a national orchestra in the Netherlands that's won many Grammy Awards and has recorded with everyone from Elvis Costello to Chaka Khan. And
they groove.
They're the orchestra that grooves, I would say. You know, they came to one of the live recording sessions for We Like It Here in Utrecht, and they came up to me after the show and they said, hey, we love what you guys are doing. If you ever want to do anything together, let me know. And I was like, well, how about a record? And they said, okay. And I was thinking, is it really that easy? You know, because normally my whole life I've been trying to convince people to do the crazy stuff that's in my head and begging them and promising them that it's going to be cool and all this stuff. And now to throw a crazy idea at someone and for them to say, sure, it's strange. I don't think I'll ever get used to that after getting rejected for 10 years, you know. But so we had this meeting a couple days after meeting them at We Like It Here. The ball got put in motion. And in April of 2014, we convened the 12-piece, I believe, at that point, Snarky Puppy, and the 52-piece Metropole Orchestra in a town called Dordrecht, which I'm butchering the pronunciation of. In the Netherlands, kind of near Rotterdam, and in this place called the Energy House, which is like an old energy station that's been converted into a lot of different things, but one of them is a performance space, a gigantic performance space. So we set this orchestra up all around the room. We put the audience in the middle, and because the theme of the content that I was writing was about all these different forests I've been in my life. Each song is about a different forest. I kind of half jokingly threw out to the people in the Metropole a week before the session that I thought it would be cool if we turned the room into a forest.
In proper Mike League fashion, a week before.
Maybe it was two weeks before. Maybe it was more. It definitely wasn't more than a few weeks before the session.
You had to create something to give you that.
To make sure that something could go horribly wrong, yes. Because the Dutch are very organized, and they were very well prepared for what we were doing, so I had to give them a curveball, I think. So I was standing there with two of the managers from the Metropole, and I said, yeah, you know, I was thinking it might be cool if we just turned this gigantic room into a forest. And they went, hmm. And I thought, okay, that's probably a no. And then they both disappeared. And like 5 minutes later, they came back and they said, okay, well, we just talked to this guy who we know makes, like, turns things into trees. And this other guy who's like a metalsmith who can build all this stuff, and we know this person who owns a nursery, and I mean, these guys, it's amazing, the Dutch, they're incredible, and especially the Metropole people. I mean, just no idea is too crazy for them. If they think it's going to work and going to be effective, they just make it happen, man. You know,
you sound like your people.
They're my people, and they are my people.
And this is what impresses me most about you, Mike League, is your ability to have a vision. No matter how, like, extraordinary or just far-fetched it is, you realize it through the support, though.
Yeah, I would say that it's just because of the people that are around, you know? I mean,
but there has to be a kernel. And, and you know, you're able to consistently outdo yourself. And you speak to your band, and they'll back this up. So it's really exciting to see how not only this musical content, but the places
right.
you'll go, as Dr. Seuss says.
Yes. Oh, the places you'll go. Yeah, it's amazing. You know, the guys in the band at this point are just like, you know, well, that's another crazy, stupid idea that Mike came up with. That's probably going to happen. So we might as well just jump in the ship, you know? And they do, and they're amazing. And they do more than jump in the ship. You know, the guys in the band, they really... What I told them was, like, for this recording with the Metropole, I said, look, I'm writing, you know, an hour-long suite of music for a 64-piece ensemble while trying to turn a room into a forest, you know, and dealing with the logistics of, like, I think we did 6 epic, you know, Red Epics cameras, which, like, you know, The Hobbit was filmed on and stuff, you know.
You know, you're in a forest.
For the, yeah, might as well go with the Hobbit vibe. So, you know, we were like, yeah, you know, there's a lot to manage in this situation. Like, I'm going to be sending you this music 2 days before we rehearse. So just learn it. Like, in those, schedule those 2 days completely open for learning this music. And they all did. I think it was the first time that's ever happened. You know, they all did. So I sent them the music. We walked into rehearsal. They knew all the parts. And it was like, wow, man. Cool, you know, I mean, that's what I'm saying, they give so much, you know, and the people on the administrative end of things, like the Metropole people, they did everything to make it as smooth and fluid as possible. And Jules Buckley, the conductors, you know, I didn't know him before we started working together. I'd never met him, and we immediately became, like, you know, brothers. It was great.
How many trees did this forest consist of?
We brought in, I believe, 6 to 8 actual olive trees, like real olive trees. And then we had a metalsmith construct like 3 or 4 kind of evil forest from Snow White style.
Tim Burton.
Right, metallic trees. And then we had this other guy who he does this like, regularly, where he takes these trees that are in this renewable forest in the Netherlands and he cuts them up in a way that they turn into like weeping willows. So, I mean, up to like 35 feet high. So we had these trees that are like 35 feet tall, engulfing the entire upper atmosphere of this room. And then we had these olive trees scattered throughout. It was really crazy. And then we brought in other shrubberies and such. The month leading up to this recording, as I was writing the thing, I was basically only listening to Stravinsky, Shostakovich, and Philip Glass. Just like, that's it. I didn't listen to anything else. Just to get 3 kind of different, but very ambitious kind of perspectives on arranging and composing.
Thank you so much for joining us in the checkout, Mike.
Thanks for having me, Alex.
Snarky Puppy with the Metropole Orchestra. WBGO's Alex Arif spoke to Snarky Puppy's Michael League. Coming up next, South African opera-trained jazz singer Melanie Schultz. This is The Checkout. I'm Simon Rettner.